this is Allison Sheridan of the NoSillaCast podcast, hosted over at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, December 14th, 2008, and this is show number 182. Well, hey, before we get started, have you run a backup this week? If you haven't, why don't you go start one right now, and it'll be done when you're done listening to the show. This week, my young friend David had a hard drive crash on his three-month-old MacBook. I had forced him to buy an external backup drive. I set up Time Machine to talk to the drive. I showed him how to plug the drive in and how it would automatically do the backup for him. Did he do backups? Heck no! He thought that maybe doing one at the end of every semester would be often enough. So do you want to be like David at college with no backups the week before finals? I didn't think so. Try to be smarter than him. He's not going to make that mistake twice. Go run a backup right now. I'll wait while you go do that. Okay, good. Glad you got that started. Well, this week's Christmas movie is Elf with Will Ferrell, Zooey Deschanel, Mary Steenburgen, James Caan, Ed Asner, and Bob Newhart. I love this movie. Zooey, in particular, is amazing. I just love her voice. She's fantastic. I hear she's in some more things soon, so I'm excited about that. You know, there's a lot of great old classics, but it's rare to find a new film that can join the ranks of the truly great feel-good Christmas movie. All right, so maybe it's not A Wonderful Life, but I'd put it up there with Charlie Brown's Christmas and The Grinch Who Stole Christmas, or at least Rudolph. In fact, my buddy Ron and I were talking about the similarities between Rudolph and Elf. If you haven't seen it, go rent it this week and watch it with the family. If you don't smile and laugh and feel good by the end, then you're probably a lost cause or possibly Scrooge.
Hi, Allison. It's Jane from Perth, Australia. It seems so long since I sent in an audio review to the NoSillaCast, and so I thought if I didn't do one soon, I might totally forget how to use GarageBand. So I've done a review, a shortish review, of a software application which I found quite useful. But before I start, I need to take a few deep breaths and calm down a little. You see, I house my 60GB iTunes library on my time capsule to save space on my teeny-weeny MacBook Pro hard drive. And before I started preparing this review, I thought I'd play some background music. So I fired up iTunes and chose a playlist. But instead of hearing relaxing music emanating from the desktop speakers, there was a deadly silence, and a window popped up saying iTunes could not find the original music file, and would I like to locate it? I tried another song, and another, but nothing, just little exclamation marks alongside each song indicating broken links. So I bet you were thinking I was going to tell you how I fixed it. Well, no, because it still isn't working. I know the iTunes library is safe because the iMac can play songs from it, but my MacBook Pro can't. So I'm musicless as I prepare this review. Okay, I'm all better now, so let me get on with the software review. Over time, I have installed more and more applications on my MacBook Pro, and I keep the icons of those apps that I use most frequently in the dock at the bottom of the screen. However, the dock has grown, and the application icons have shrunk in size to accommodate all those extra software icons. My dock now fills the width of my 27-inch screen, but when I'm away from my big screen, the dock icons on the 15-inch MacBook Pro require serious squinting to see what the icons are. The answer to my ever-growing number of icons is to be found in an application called Dock Spaces 2.10. Or should that be 2.10? I'm not quite sure how you're supposed to pronounce it. Anyway, this software application enables you to create different docks for various workflow situations. And if you use the Spaces feature within OS X Leopard, then Dock Spaces enables you to create a different dock for each Spaces desktop. I hope I explained that bit clearly enough. Dock Spaces 2.10 allows you to create up to 10 different docks containing your chosen icons. I created a dock relevant to my work, which contains Excel, Word, Parallels, Mail and Safari icons, and another dock for media creations containing iLife Suite and Photoshop icons. The preferences allow you to choose whether the dock is located horizontally along the bottom of the desktop, or vertically along the left or the right side of the desktop, and also whether the dock is left or right aligned. You can choose which of your newly created docks you wish to use by keyboard shortcuts or from the Options panel via the Dock Spaces menu bar icon. I found that the ability to allocate a different dock to each desktop within Leopard Spaces feature to be a very useful way to identify which space I was working in when flitting between spaces. You see, normally, you flit between spaces, and you have the same desktop picture. So, in my case, I'm never quite sure which space I'm in. Was it 4, 3, 1, 2? I don't know. And I end up getting so annoyed with it that I don't use spaces that much. So I thought, right, if I create a different dock for each space, poof, there you go. You know which one you're in. The one with all the iLife Suite ones is that space. The one with your works-related icons is the other space, etc., etc. However, I have actually since learned that there is another piece of software called Spacesuit, which allows you to allocate different desktop pictures to the spaces. But I digress. That's for another day. There are times when Dock Spaces 2.10 can appear slow to load a different dock, especially one with 50-plus icons like mine, which can take up to 3 seconds to load. Whereas if your alternative dock only has 20 or so icons, then it loads much faster in around 1 second. Dock Spaces 2.10 is one of three applications created by a young developer, Patrick Camilo, who is studying for a degree in software engineering. The app is available from his website, that's www.nscoding.co.uk, or via Apple's Downloads web pages. Dock Spaces 2.10 is free, although donations are welcome, and it runs on PowerPC or Intel-based Macs and requires OS 10.5. One enhancement I'd like to see would be the ability to run two docks at the same time on one desktop. I think it would be rather useful to have a dock on each side of the desktop. I've posted this review of Dock Spaces 2.10 on my website at galacticstrings.com, where you can follow the links to the developer's website and to Apple's software applications download pages. And if you're really bored this holiday season, you can follow my ramblings on Twitter at twitter.com/Jane73. That's the number 73. Take care, happy holidays to everyone out there, and see you all next time.
Well, thanks, Jane. What a nice review. That sounds pretty cool. You know, I still don't use spaces as much as I think I should. Every time I try it, the thing I need next is in another space. Like I tried to use it today. I was writing this show in Feeder, but I needed to see a link in my FTP client. But I can't remember what it said by the time I flip back because I'd flip over to it. It flipped to a different space. I'd try to memorize the name and I'd get back and it'd be gone already. So I need them both in the same space. So I end up going into F8 and then pulling it over and then kind of defeating the purpose. I kept going and getting stuff and moving over the space I was in. I keep trying though. Maybe I'll get it going soon. I hope you give Spacesuit a try too. That might really help in addition to the Dock Spaces thing. Do a review if you try it. That would be cool.
Dumb.
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 Dumb questions.
Dumb questions.
Dumb questions.
How do I? What is?
How come I always have to?
It's time for Dumb Question Corner.
Well, I gotta tell you, I lied last week when I said I didn't have any dumb questions. What I should have said was that I didn't get any dumb questions that I could actually answer. This week I got one I could. Hi, Allison. I'm submitting a dumb question on behalf of my mother. You see, she's got an iPhone as well. She's missing her music. It's less than a gig, and she's having trouble downloading her playlist to her iPhone. Some instructions would be greatly appreciated. Oh, and it should be said that she has iTunes on a Windows 5-plus-year-old machine. I can certainly sympathize with a mom having an old machine, you know that. Well, there's finally an iPhone question, iTunes iPhone question I think I can help with. We'll see if I get the right answer here. I hope BJ will let me know whether this was actually the question that he had. Well, the main trick of dealing with the iPhone is to pay attention to what happens in iTunes when you plug it in. If you look on the left-hand sidebar of iTunes, you'll see a section called Devices, and you should see the iPhone in the list of devices, showing the name that you gave it to it when you first set it up. If you select the iPhone, you'll notice that a set of tabs shows up across the top of the iTunes window. One of those tabs is for music. If you click on that, you're going to see an option to sync music, and then you can choose specific playlists or all songs in playlists. You can also change whether to sync music videos from the same menu. I hope this gives her a good starting point. I'm betting the sync music button somehow got unchecked. I do like that they gave us all these options because, you know, you do have to manage your iPhone rather carefully if you have a ton of music or videos, because the iPhone's only, what, if you got the lowest end one, it was 4 gig when it came out, then there's the 8 gig and maybe 16 gig if she's really lucky. You might want to help her explore the photos and video tabs too. It'll sync photos from iPhoto or Aperture, and you can select albums just like you do playlists over in music. Maybe you only want to show them photos she's taken in the last week or the last month. You can do that too. We'll get her iPhone filled up yet. Well, this week I had the fun of starting to test out the BlackBerry Storm. It was really hard, but I made an effort to not read any of the reviews out there or watch any of the videos. Like, I didn't even look at David Pogue's because a bunch of people told me it was highly unfavorable, but I didn't want to hear someone else's opinion first. In case you haven't heard about it at all, the Storm is Research in Motion's first foray into a touchscreen BlackBerry. Now, don't confuse this with the BlackBerry Bold, which came out at the same time, which is a handsome device, which is the obvious evolution of the traditional BlackBerry, having a real keyboard and the nice little trackball in the middle. In addition to my iPhone, I also use a BlackBerry 8800 extensively, and I find that as an email device, it's quite good. If I had to choose whether to use my iPhone or my BlackBerry just to type on, I would give a slight edge to the BlackBerry. I'm getting pretty good on the iPhone now, but you don't have to get good on the BlackBerries with the real keyboard because they just work. You don't have to learn what they want you to do. Well, Research in Motion decided that they had to come out with a competitor to the iPhone, so they made their own version of the touchscreen. One complaint people have with the iPhone has been that there's no tactile feedback. I can agree with that. You know, we have a Garmin GPS unit that has the most pleasing feel when you type on the touchscreen. You can really tell you've connected with each letter. I would swear you can feel it. I don't know what it is. The one downside is it's not a QWERTY keyboard, but that's a whole nother review over there. Well, anyway, so Research in Motion decided they needed to have tactile feedback. Tactile, not tactical. Got to get that word right. Anyway, they decided that if the entire screen actually depressed when you clicked on it, you'd get that tactile feedback. I did it again, that tactile feedback you were missing. Except they did it all wrong. The touchscreen on the Storm depresses all right, but like I said, the whole thing depresses. So instead of the energy and effort required to press a small button, you're actually pressing down on the entire 3¼-inch screen, which actually takes a great deal of effort. I mean, it's not like lifting a barbell or anything, but if you're worried about repetitive stress injuries from typing on your current BlackBerry, it's only going to get worse. The screen on the Storm is absolutely gorgeous. Like I said, it's 3¼ inches across. The color and clarity and brightness of it are just a joy to view. In the options, I was able to set the font big enough for my 50-year-old eyes to see it easily. Plus, it had the added advantage of driving the young people crazy that I let test it because they're like, why you got the font so big? That was fun. My next favorite thing was the camera. Instead of the anemic camera on the iPhone, the Storm has a 3-megapixel camera with actual autofocus and an actual flash. Works so much better. The photos off this camera are significantly better than the iPhone camera. That is, as long as your subject can wait several seconds while you take the photo. It seems to hesitate a long time before you can take a picture, and there's an even bigger lag after you take a picture. The screen just goes blank for a really long time. Again, the photos are great, but you have to be willing to wait for them. Well, let's talk about the keyboard to get it over with. It's horrible. No. It's awful, dreadful, a nightmare. Okay, maybe not a nightmare, but a really, really bad dream. I already said how you have to press down the whole screen, and, you know, that would be okay if it helped you in any way to hit the right keys. But it doesn't. It just makes it harder. It adds no value whatsoever other than to make it harder to type. When you rest your finger on a key, it glows gently to show you what key you're on. But it glows under your finger, which means you still can't tell which key you're on. The iPhone pops up the letter above the key so you can see quite vividly which key you're actually on. No, the Storm does it under your finger where you can't see it. You can kind of tell a little glow around your finger, but it's not obvious which one you're on. I guess I should also explain that there are three different keyboard options. When I first got the Storm in portrait mode, you know, vertically, it had a cell phone keyboard. They call that mode multi-tap. So that's the kind of keyboard that has three letters on each key, like a telephone. You know, the kind where you have to hit the key multiple times to get it to register the letter you want. Not exactly what I was looking for, but I know the kids today are pretty good at this. I don't know how you do a password or something like that on it. That'd be really hard because you can't see what letters it's doing. Anyway, if you flip it in landscape mode, it's a beautiful QWERTY keyboard. You can use landscape QWERTY in email, just like they don't let you on the iPhone. Well, that would be great, except for some reason it's actually really hard to hit the right letter. Oh, you know, that might seem like a little nit, but it turns out that it's actually an important part of this whole typing process to hit the right letter. I had a lot of trouble with the left side of the keyboard in particular. Trying to hit a Q was a real challenge. I had a Q in my password, and it took me 5 days before I ever got my password right on the first try. I did discover something new, that after 5 tries, they actually let you see the text you're trying to type. That is not a good thing to know. I can now get my password right, though, on the first try almost half the time. Well, the good news is that the portrait mode has a third type of keyboard. I found it buried down in the options. It's called SureType. I actually kind of like it. This keyboard has two letters on each key, and the software just pretty much figures out what you mean. Now, that works well on real words, but if your password's got numbers and letters and all that kind of stuff in it, it's not going to help you out. But in regular typing, my accuracy went up significantly when I switched to this mode. Unfortunately, no matter what keyboard you use, the software is slow. If you try to type as fast as you can on a traditional BlackBerry, you'll find that the Storm gets as many as 3 or 4 words behind you. That's not what you want either. Well, I checked out the options to see if there were any ways to improve the keyboard accuracy. They do have some options, but I didn't understand them. For example, they have touchscreen tap interval. The default is 400, and there's an option to change it from 100 to 500 in 50-unit intervals. 400 what? Milliseconds? I don't know. And is a lot? What does a lot do? What does a little do? I don't know. Anyway, they also have swipe sensitivity from 1 to 5, where the default is 3. Swipe sensitivity. Is 1 easier or harder to swipe? Well, I tried both ends of the spectrum on that one, and it pretty much didn't notice any change at all when I did both of them. Couldn't swipe very well in either one. Well, the next little problem I had might seem like a little bit of a nitpicky thing, but it seems like they made a really odd choice here. If you need to enter a number, you hit the number button just like you would on the iPhone, but it instantly reverts back to letters after you've hit the number. Well, how often do you type a single numerical digit compared to a string of numbers? Well, let's see, dates, times, temperature, money, they all use more than one number. But on the Storm, you have to either keep hitting the number button to get back into it, or the first time you hit it, you have to hold it down extra long till it glows, and then it'll stick. I find that a very odd choice. Well, I also had a really, really interesting crash. It was a crash sort of thing. I don't know if you call it a crash, but it was definitely a huge failure. It was on the very first day. The battery was getting low, so I looked for the charger. Guess what? It's a non-standard USB connector. Yep, they came up with their own kind of connector. It's not a mini USB-A. No. It's a proprietary new kind of, or maybe it's a not proprietary, but it's a new kind of connector. Of all the things I want BlackBerry to steal from Apple, the idea to make non-standard connectors was not on that list. That's one of the things I hate about Apple. They're always coming out with these stupid new connectors like the dock connector, that kind of thing. Why would BlackBerry do this? Somebody said it charges faster, but I would much rather have a charge with a charger I happen to have in my bag than coming up with another one. Okay, back to the crash thingy. So I plugged the charger in and I left it for a while. I came back and I unplugged it and the Verizon splash screen came up. All right, well, maybe I let it drain all the way. I didn't think I did, but maybe it's rebooting. Well, when it came up time for the login, it came up, I started to type, and the camera came on. Now remember, I'm not logged in, so I can't have turned it on myself, and I also can't turn it off because I can't log in because the camera view is covering about 75% of the screen. Not full screen, but 75% of it. I pushed every button on that darn thing, and finally, I had to pull the battery to get it to stop. Well, anyway, so the next most important thing to do with a business smartphone is web browsing. Unfortunately, most websites don't auto-sense the BlackBerry browser, so you get a full browser view by default, which is impossible to read. Can't see it at all. The folks at RIM came up with an interesting solution that kind of works. They have a button that toggles the browser to what they call column view. This view, in most of my testing, was very readable and clear because they basically eliminate any sidebars and kind of, increase the size of the font, and they kind of zoom in on the text in the main body. To zoom in further, a simple click down on the screen does the trick. Unfortunately, on some websites, when you zoom in, the browser draws lines across the screen, effectively doing a strike through of the text. I cannot believe they shipped a product that would do this. Did they seriously not check zooming in? Another issue is that while the column view looks lovely in one orientation, if you rotate the screen, it doesn't expand or contract to adapt to the new orientation. So, I mean, like if you start in portrait mode in the column view, if you rotate it to landscape view, the web browser doesn't expand to fit the width of the screen. It's only using a third of the screen or something, or two thirds of the screen. If you start in landscape and then you switch to portrait while you're in column view, it makes the text fall off the edge of the screen. Again, seriously, you thought this was good. You thought it was ready to ship. Final product. Really? That's what you were thinking? All right. I'm not close to done yet, by the way. Anyway, this next web browsing complaint defies explanation. My BlackBerry Storm has a real thing against Google. They have a Google bookmark built in. But it says, if I click it, it says, you've got an unsupported media type application /SOAP+XML. Huh? All right. I tried typing in google.com in the go-to section, but I get the same error. No worries, they've got a Google search field built in too. I typed in my search term and I click the big Google button next to it. And it turns out the big Google button does not take you to Google. It gives you a pull down to change it from Google to Wikipedia or dictionary.com. Well, after literally 6 days of playing with this thing, I finally figured out that if you've just typed in the search term and you still have your keyboard up, you can use the carriage return on the keyboard to get it to go to Google. If you've already gotten out of the keyboard, you're toast. You got to start over. So finally, I got into Google for the first time today, actually. I go into column view so I can actually see the results, and it rendered so badly that the word search results were actually splatted on top of the first search result. Seriously, you didn't check this on Google. I mean, I can see some of the other websites I checked having the strike through. Maybe you didn't know it, did that on some kinds of sites or something. But Google, you didn't check Google in column view. You didn't look to see if that worked. Oh, what else don't I like? Oh, the scroll bars don't work on web pages either. Am I being mean, or should I expect that to work? Oh, another, I like this too. The clock turns itself on at random times, full screen. Just comes on full screen, on the clock. Buddy of mine's testing one too, and the same thing happened to him. It also seems to flip between portrait and landscape sometimes without provocation. Just does it. In many cases, it simply ignores me trying to scroll a window. Trying to do that swipe thing, it just ignores me, doesn't do anything. This thing is a constant adventure of stupid little glitches. It really feels like a prototype operating system to give you an idea of how it could work, when they get it finished. All right, I'll try to say something nice here. I did install a couple of applications, and the installer worked flawlessly. I installed AIM on it, and I had no complaints at all. Well, next up, I tested transferring media files to the Storm. Even though the Storm doesn't work with a Mac for tethering and desktop software, it easily worked as a USB mass storage device. Obvious folders were available for me for music, video, documents, ringtones, and voice notes. Oh, I should mention, it comes free with an 8 GB micro SD card already installed, which was very cool of them. Because, I mean, that's only like 20, 30, 40 bucks, something like that. But still, that was kind of a nice feature. I dragged several MP3 files over to it, some podcasts, and some songs I'd ripped from CDs. I also dragged an assortment of video files over, some video podcasts as well as some homemade movies. Some worked, some didn't, and I did not find an obvious reason why the videos didn't work. I was really careful not to try any protected content, so that wasn't the problem. But I don't want to give a ding to the Storm here. Have I mentioned that video is really hard? It's so easy to just have the slightest change in a video encoding process that boogers it up in some way. The audio quality was really quite good out of the built-in speakers, and the Storm comes with stereo earbuds as well. All of the audio files worked perfectly, by the way. and the video quality looked fantastic. The control for volume had some problems. Sometimes it would make the volume go up and down, but about half the time it just skipped to the next song or video. Yet again, this feels like a prototype. By the way, I'm talking about the physical button on the right-hand side. It would switch to skipping to the next song. I have no idea why it would do that. Next, I tested out the video capability, and it blew my socks off. I was really impressed with the indoor light capability, and it was really good at adjusting for dramatic changes in light. For a cell phone camera, it did a great job. The file it created was 320 by 240 with a file extension of .3GP. It was encoded with H.264 and AMR narrowband audio. Well, I didn't know what that was, so I looked it up on Wikipedia, and I learned that 3GP is a multimedia container format defined by the Third Generation Partnership Project, otherwise known as 3GPP, for use on 3G mobile phones. I put a link in the show notes to the video so you can see how good it looks. My final test of the BlackBerry Storm was to see how tethering worked. Unfortunately, they don't have a version of VZ Access for the Storm for the Mac. That's a software from Verizon that lets you use cell-type devices to connect to high-speed networks. I've used VZ Access from Verizon for my EVDO card on the Mac, but they're not supporting the Storm for some reason, at this time anyway. Not a big loss. Anyway, I downloaded and installed VZ Access on my Vista machine, and the installation and setup could not have been more intuitive or easier. It was fantastic. You know I don't believe in reading manuals, so this was a dream for me. I ran the setup software, and it asked me whether I was going to use the cable or Bluetooth. Fortunately, this lovely laptop, I've told you before how much I like it, it does not appear to have Bluetooth, so I went with the cable. I then opened VZ Access, I hit connect, and instantly I was online. I ran a speed test over at speakeasy.net/speedtest, and I got a very respectable 1.3 megabits down and 433 kilobits up. I was delighted with the entire experience of tethering the Storm to my laptop. I should warn you that you have to enable tethering through Verizon, and they charge you extra to set up your plan that way. But at least they let you, unlike AT&T with the iPhone. All right, let me bottom line it for you here. I would not recommend the BlackBerry Storm to anyone under any circumstances at this time. It's buggy, it's glitchy, it really feels like a prototype. I mean, in spite of the good camera for both stills and video and the ease of use as a tethering device, it's the most difficult to type on device I've ever used. I mean, you buy a BlackBerry to type email primarily and make phone calls. And if you can't do half of those functions easily, then it doesn't fit a real need. It's slow, the buttons don't provide consistent functionality, web browsing is slightly better than the older BlackBerries, but not nearly as usable as the iPhone, scrolling doesn't work half the time, and it uses a non-standard charging cable. Other than that, I loved it. You know, I really feel like some vice president walked into the office and said, "Apple's had a touchscreen phone out for 2 years and we're not out. We're shipping this thing. I don't care if it's done or not." Seriously, that's how bad this thing feels. And now a word from our sponsors, the lovely folks Trevor and Greg over at ScreenSteps.com. ScreenSteps is a wonderful tool for the Mac or Windows that lets you create beautiful documentation for computer-based things with just so little effort, you'll cringe when you look back on how you used to struggle with Word to do it. I cannot believe how many times I realized that ScreenSteps is the right tool for the job. I think I use it for a lot of things they never intended. Picture this scenario. I was beta testing an automatic installation program for someone. As I went through the install, things started to go horribly wrong. I popped up ScreenSteps, and as the installer crashed and burned, I took screenshots of each of the error screens. I annotated the screens and showed the menus that I clicked on next so the developer could follow exactly what happened. I added text to each step to explain what I did and what the effects were. I was even able to cut and paste an error log file into ScreenSteps, so it was included for the developer as well. When I was done, I simply hit the export to HTML file, I FTP'd it up to a web server, and I sent the link to the developer. He got a nicely formatted and complete rundown on every step of the process so he can analyze it and figure out how to fix it. I know that's not what the ScreenSteps people intended, but it was so useful for me. I didn't have to download a bunch of images, then paste them into an email or Word or something and try to recreate what I did and remember what I did. I had them all in one easy-to-manage place. I tell you, if you've got to manage any kind of documentation, even short little tutorials for your friends or family, all the way up to huge manuals for your software development project, check out the free trial of ScreenSteps over at ScreenSteps.com. And when you inevitably decide to buy it, be sure to use the coupon code NOSILLA, that's my name spelled backwards, in all capital letters, and you get a 25% discount off the purchase price. With that discount code, it's only $30 for the personal version, and it'll make your life so much happier. Don't you deserve ScreenSteps? Hey, ask for it for Christmas. You know, while we've been chatting away in the chat room on the live stream over at ustream.tv/NoSillaCast, we got a couple of people in there said they were already using ScreenSteps and loved it. I've got Sean Lindo on Skype here for a quick conversation. He's here from Box.net. He's the community manager over at Box.net. So let's see. First, tell us what Box.net is, and then maybe you can tell us what a community manager is.
Sure, sure. So Box.net is a web-based service where people can store, access, and share files online. So it means pretty much anything that you want to put up, whether it's your standard productivity documents, your photos, your videos, your music. You know, once you have it online, you can access that from any PC that's connected to the internet, and you can also share individual files and folders with anybody using Box.
And by PC, you mean PC, Mac, and,
exactly.
And even the iPhone, huh?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, that's pretty cool. So what's a community manager?
So basically, as an online community manager, I'm the voice of Box to the online community, including, tech blogs, tech sites, and, tech podcasts just like these. And, the job of the community manager is to not only spread the word about Box through as many online channels as possible, but also to really get feedback from the community on what we're doing well and what we're not doing so well. So, it kind of works both ways as kind of a liaison between the online community and Box itself.
That's what I love about working with small companies and freeware and shareware developers is the access to actually, say, hey, this would be better if you fix this, and people write back and go, oh, gee, I really appreciate that. Let me fix that.
Yeah, and that's really put Box.net on the scene was the relationships that the co-founders had with the online community and the word that they were able to spread out through sites like Engadget, and it just took off like wildfire from there.
Now, I used Box.net, started using it quite a long time ago. I believe I did a review on it. I know my friend Ron went with us to Italy, and he had a lot of photographs that we forgot to get from him right before we separated after the trip. So he just uploaded them to Box.net, and I was able to download them from there.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and that's the whole idea is not so much the online storage part of it, but it's what people can do with their files once it's on Box. So in addition to the sharing aspect that you just mentioned, we also have something called Open Box Services, which is basically web services and applications that tie directly into Box. So if you want to do something like if you had a spreadsheet that you want to edit online, you could edit that using Zoho right through Box. So you could just open your file on Box, click a menu, say edit with Zoho, make all your edits, changes, and say save, and it saves it directly back into Box. So it's almost like recreating the desktop integration and experience, but just taking it to the online space and the online browser. And you can do the same things with photos. If you want to edit in Picnic, say edit with Picnic, do your edits, say save, saves it right back into Box, without any kind of separate uploading and downloading and all that kind of messy stuff.
Man, this is fantastic. I'm just going to waste a bunch of bandwidth and pay no attention to you because I uploaded my Christmas list in Excel while we were talking about it. Now I just clicked on it and I'm able to edit it in Zoho, but it looks like I'm exactly still in Box.net.
Right, wow. Right. And I mean, the cool thing is that, once you click save, it just goes right back into Box like it's your, kind of like your local hard drive. Only all of this is just, stuff that you can access anywhere.
Oh, this is so cool. I love this.
Yeah. I mean, that's the cool thing. I mean, like when we first started Box, our co-founders, Aaron Levy, the CEO, he was all about keeping Box open. So instead of, trying to make people use, certain application services, only by Box, we wanted to keep it open so that if you wanted to use, your docs or your photos with, Picnic or Zoho or Think Free or Word or whatever you wanted, that we would let people do that using the Open Box platform. So, we opened you know, box through some third-party APIs, and developers like Picnic and Zoho were able to tie their service directly into ours. And just yesterday we released an open box service from MindMeister, and they're kind of a cool, neat web service where you can do mind maps and brainstorming diagrams, all that kind of stuff. And so you can now, using that open box service with Box, you can actually create MindMeister mind maps using Box.net.
Wait, what company was that? I'm crazy about playing with mind mapping applications.
It's called MindMeister.
MindMeister. I'll have to check those guys out. And you integrate with those too, huh?
Yeah, that just went live yesterday.
Oh, wow.
And we have like tons of other things, like if you want to do an eFax or do kind of a digital signature on a contract, all those we have a service for those tied into Box as well. A few weeks ago we announced a partnership with LinkedIn for their applications platform. So using your LinkedIn profile, you can link your profile back to your Box.net account and choose a folder. So, for example, with me, I want to share, some cool websites, some interviews that I've done, some podcasts that I've done. And so I put all those in, something I call a profile documents folder, and I share that with everybody on my LinkedIn profile. So people can go in and listen to a podcast that I did with iPhone Alley, or just read an interview that I did, using that integration with LinkedIn and Box. So I mean, it's pretty cool. I mean, just for us to be able to work with all these types of different companies.
Wow, that is cool. I just noticed when I go into, I did a preview of my application because I've been in there editing my Excel file, like I said, over in Zoho. And then I noticed it brings it up in ScribeD, which is the iPaper, they call it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's pretty cool. Wow. This is really, really interesting, all the different things you're doing here.
Yeah, and we have about 20 services tied into Box right now.
Holy cow. This has gone a long way since the last time I played with it. And I'm not paying any attention to you anymore. I'm just playing with Box.
That's all right. It's okay with me.
That's not the worst thing. Well, when we were on the phone earlier, we started talking about how you're doing Skype right now.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So I'm doing Skype through the Dell Mini 9 netbook. And, as I was saying before, it's an interesting thing for us because we did a partnership with Dell to provide Dell Mini 9 owners with free online storage from Box. And so we give people 2 gigs of online storage, complete with the services that, that we're talking about now. And, people obviously have the option to move up to a paid plan if they want more storage, more bandwidth, or greater flexibility if they're working within a company and they want some more collaboration tools.
Wow, that's pretty cool. Yeah, I'm looking at it right now. The low-end Inspiron Mini 9 comes with 2 gigabytes of free internet storage from Box.net.
Yeah, and all of them do. And yeah, and you can upgrade to our paid plan starts at 5 gigs, and that includes unlimited bandwidth, upload file sizes of up to 1 gig. If people are just using it for, if you're a college student or high school student, you just want to store documents online, obviously 2 gigs is great for that use.
Which of the Mini 9s did you buy?
I bought the mid-grade version. So it has 16 gigs of solid state storage, 1 gig of RAM, and Windows XP built into it.
Didn't go Linux, huh?
No, you know what? I was going to do that, but then I wanted to try out a few things that I knew was only going to be Windows based. So, I went with the safe route, so to speak.
Yeah, it's funny how that's exactly what I did when I got the HP Mini Note. I went with I really wanted to do the Linux version to be a rebel, but then I thought, I really got to try the XP on it. And actually, they did something awful with it, though. They insisted that you had to buy it with Vista Home.
Oh, yeah.
And it's nowhere near capable of running Vista. I mean, not even close. It was horrific. So we scraped that off and put XP on it.
Yeah, and it's crazy. I mean, there are different companies that are just trying to, discourage you from using XP. And, I think XP is still a great OS if you want to stick with Windows, because it's pretty snappy. It's, it doesn't crash. It works fine.
Yeah, it works
fine. And I could have gone the Ubuntu route because, I have, a couple of Macs at home, and my wife has a MacBook with Windows installed on there. So, I mean, I could have gotten by with that. But, just as far as just, having complete control over one notebook, it was just easier just to go XP.
Yeah. Looks like this is about $450. What do you think of it? Do you like the solid state drive?
I do. I mean, one thing I notice is that it's just, you know, it's completely silent. You know, kind of take that for granted, but it's like, wow, this thing does not make any noise. It's pretty snappy. I can watch web videos pretty easily. And, since we're talking about Box, you know, I have a lot of stuff as far as like work documents and pictures stored on Box. So, you know, the local storage isn't really an issue for me.
Oh, that's a good point. You only have 16 gig, but what do you care? You've got Box.net.
Exactly right. So, I mean, you know, 16
gigs
is
enough for me. Maybe that's where we're going to get to, though, right?
Yeah.
Maybe we only need enough memory to, get to the internet, and then everything else is up in the cloud, like they say, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's why netbooks, I think, will take off a little bit better than a lot of skeptics would say, just because, you know, if you give it a nice screen, if you give it a pretty zippy processor, good enough RAM, as long as it's good enough to do, online stuff well, I think that's what a lot of people need, and they don't really need much more than that if they're just using it for your basic home computer, even just doing schoolwork.
Yeah, gotta confess, I bought this new MacBook Pro whenever they came out. What was it, 4 or 5 weeks ago, 6 weeks ago, something like that? I haven't launched Microsoft Word yet.
Yeah.
what do I need Word for? Why would I do that? I mean, I'm much more likely in Chit Chat Across the Pond with Bart Bouchatz, we're talking about wikis. I'm much more likely to write in a wiki or some other online document creation utility than I am Word. I mean, why would I load Word?
Exactly. And you know, if you really need that functionality, you know, I loaded OpenOffice on this machine because it's completely free and it does exactly what the standard Office suite does.
Now, I got to say, I am an Excel fanatic. I love Excel. So I like that. I see no need for Word, and I think PowerPoint was written by Satan. So I'm kind of middle of the road on Word. I just, it's not that upsetting. It's just unnecessary.
Yeah. And as you mentioned before, with all these different services like Zoho and ThinkFree, which also happen to tie in a Box, you have all the options in the world to be able to do word processing well, and still have it on the cloud, so you can access it on any computer, which is the cool thing.
That's really cool. Well, this has been pretty neat talking to you. I appreciate the little quick review of the Dell Mini 9 and learning so much more about Box.net. This is it's kind of fun having somebody walk you through it, because if you've been listening to my show at all, I don't read manuals or any documentation.
Yeah. Exactly.
I like the private lesson you just gave me here.
Yeah, no, and definitely look out for more updates from the service. And like you said, we're doing some apps on the iPhone and some other mobile devices. So yeah, it's a pretty exciting time.
Yeah, I'd like to get you back on when you've done some more stuff with the iPhone app. That'd be great.
Definitely, be more than happy to.
All right, thanks a lot, Sean.
All right, thanks.
So Honda Bob has a great website over at hdabob.com where he teaches all about cars. You can pretty much look up any component in your car and find a top-level view of how it works and why it's there. I've told you how much Bob enjoys teaching and how he lets Steve ask him, I think, 238 questions every time he comes over. Well, this website is yet another example of his desire to teach. Before the web was in vogue, Bob created a manual, and he would deliver new pages to us for it. But it's not all seriousness over on Bob's site. He has a section in there called Interesting Travel Stories. He's had some amazing experiences, and this week he added a story of how his engine caught fire. Seriously, check it out. I put a link in the show notes so you can read all about it. Once you're done reading about his inflammatory issues, then do what you've been wanting to do all along and give him a call to come do your maintenance on your Honda or Acura. You can find him at 562-531-2321. Or if you're a geek like me, just email him over at hdabob@aol.com. Oh, don't forget, you have to live in the LA or Orange County areas to have the fun of having Honda Bob come to your house. HDA Bob's mobile service is not affiliated with Honda, Acura, or Honda Worldwide. It's that time of day again. It's time for Chit Chat Across the Pond with Bart Bouchatz from BartB.ie. How are things in lovely Ireland today, Bart?
Cold. I think that's the only word for it. It's bloody freezing, quite literally.
Oh, did it stop raining?
Oh, yeah. And then it started freezing straight away. What a good combination.
Good day to not own a car, I guess.
Yeah, although I actually had to go into work this morning, and my boss was ever so grateful because she lives sort of out in the country, and it was very icy out there, and so she was really happy that I was happy to cycle in.
So you got your hot water bottle, you ready to do a chit-chat?
Yep, sounds about right.
Sounds good. All right, well, we have two subjects on the agenda today. One of the things I thought might be fun to talk about was how we both got started in the Mac and, you know, where that all came from, because I think we took two fairly different paths into here. Why don't you start?
Okay. It all started way back in 2004.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. You're such a noob.
I know. Oh, I know I am. No, at this stage, I was really disenchanted with Windows. I was struggling along on Win 2K. And I believe I used to refer to Windows XP as Fisher-Price Windows.
I remember that.
And I was just getting really, you know, hacked off of this whole Genuine Advantage and all this phoning home malarkey, and it just was not for me.
Wasn't Win 2K one of the good ones, though? I thought that was one of the best OSs.
You know, Win 2K was, but at this stage, it was a case of, I can't stay in Win 2K forever. So WinXP had all this lovely carry-on. And, you know, I could only cling on to Win2K for so long. And I decided to hell with that, and I jumped into Linux and went with Fedora Core 1 and then later Fedora Core 2, if anyone can remember that far back.
Wow. So this is on your desktop at work or at home, or where's this?
Both. I have a habit of not doing things by half, so I changed both my home and my work machine to Linux.
Oh, wow.
At work, actually, we had these. They were given to us for free. At this stage, I was a PhD student, so work was sort of not really work. It was more school. And we had these workstations that HP had donated to us, and they were really fantastic when they were new, but that was a while ago. They were HP Kayaks, and we used to refer to them as HP Kacks, which I believe is the German for poo.
You guys are just such rebels.
Yeah, they were actually very funny. They were these huge machines, and they had an LCD panel on the front with a smiley face. And if there was anything wrong with the hardware, it became a sad face.
Because they thought you were morons?
Yeah, I know. It's insane. So I went to my advisor, and I went, I want a new machine because this, quite frankly, sucks. And he went, okay, but I'm not buying you a PC. And I was like, what? He says, either a Mac or nothing.
Wow.
So I said, okay, I really do hate those CACs a lot. So he got me an eMac, which he was nice enough to extend to 756 megs of RAM.
Wow, that's a lot in 2004.
Exactly. It was an insane amount of RAM in 2004, which I love that machine, actually. And he also bought me the fancy stand so that the thing actually wasn't sitting on the table, but was actually up and adjustable, which was an extra €50.
Now, I thought the eMac was that it was like an iMac, only huge.
It was like the old CRT iMacs.
Right, right.
Only it was white instead of Bondi blue.
With a big flat screen, right?
Well, no, it was a CRT.
Right, but it was flat. I didn't say thin, I said flat, right? The front of it was flat instead of curved like the old ones?
It was still pretty curvy. It looked to me maybe it wasn't quite as curvy as the Bondi blue ones. Maybe it was technically a flat screen, but it certainly never struck me as being completely flat.
Oh, okay. I could be misremembering. I never actually used one, but I saw them.
Okay.
So was that a good machine?
I love that little machine, but as I say, without the little stand to actually lift it up off the desk, which did cost €50, and it sort of introduced me to the concept that with Apple, you sort of pay for everything. You know, they sort of like to get you again. But no, I love that machine. I used it for a very long time. And then I was lucky enough to get to administer our project server, which happened to be a Duo G4 Power Mac, which I also love that machine. And then in early 2005, I took the plunge after watching, it would have been Macworld in January when Steve demoed the Mac Mini. I bought one, and that was my first Mac, the G4 Mac Mini.
Oh, wow.
I have to say, I took to OS X like a duck to water. In them days, it was Panther was the hot new thing. And I loved it, with one exception. I positively, absolutely, totally, and utterly hated with a fiery passion the Finder.
How can you love the Mac and hate the Finder? Did you live in a terminal?
I have changed, okay? But I was used to the Explorer.exe style of, you know, sidebar down the sides with all your folders, and then a window with all your files. And I copied files by clicking and dragging into that big hierarchy of folders. And this concept of having multiple windows instead of having one big window that you did everything in, it just didn't click with me for quite some time.
Well, maybe you but didn't change, though, because Apple Finder did change. They stole that from XP, or from Windows, right? So we have the sidebar now, so you can drag things that way.
But no, we don't have that full hierarchical
That's
view.
True. You don't have the full hierarchy.
We never inherited that.
But you can have
However, I've changed. And now I absolutely positively adore the Finder. And I think that people who think the Finder is crap don't know how to use the Finder. It all comes down to being good with the shortcut keys. And once you know the shortcut keys, there is no quicker way to deal with your files than the Finder. The other thing actually I missed was like some proper application launcher, but Tiger solved that. So, not Tiger, Leopard. So I'm very happy with that. Because before that, I used to run my own application launcher on top of OS X.
Right. Now, you use Spotlight to launch your apps now?
I do, and I find that it works absolutely fine. There's no problem with it at all. No, it does.
No, it doesn't. It's not as good as using Quicksilver.
I find it is, because it means I can sit down at anyone's Mac without having to make any changes or install any software and just work without having to go, oh my God, how do I do this now that I don't have my custom little crutch available?
Yeah, it's good for that if you have to change Macs. I don't change Macs very often, though. Or if it's if I change Macs, they're Macs I control, so I put Quicksilver on everything I can touch.
See, that doesn't work in a university environment. I can't very well go up to some random lecturer whose Mac is malfunctioning and say, give me one moment here till I install some software before I can help you.
Yeah, okay. So I guess it's better for that.
Yeah.
But anyway.
So that was how I got into my Macs.
When you talk about using keyboard shortcuts to be faster in the Finder, what do you mean? Like copy and paste? To copy a file and paste it into another location?
Let me see. Apple N, Apple W, Apple O, Apple Up.
I never use Apple. I would have called it Command, but Apple Up and Down, I never use that.
It takes you up a level in the hierarchy. Very handy.
That's kind of fun. Well, my path in was not at all like that, actually. In 1984, my friend Calvin Wong asked Steve and I to come over to his house to see this new invention called the Macintosh. He had the 128K model, and that was, you know, obviously the first one that was out. We were almost instantly sold. I think Steve was most excited by hearing, I think it was Money for Nothing and Chicks for Free was the first music to come out of the Mac. It was pretty cool. So we bought I can't remember. It might be that song. It's that group, whoever that was. But anyway, we bought the 512K Mac for $3,000. Now, I find it ironic that no matter what Mac I buy, I always spend $3,000. There was one exception, and I'll tell you about that in a minute, but we bought the 512K Mac for $3,000. But I'll have you know that did include a 10-unit box of 400K floppies that we only paid $100 for.
How many did you say?
10. They were single-sided 400K floppies.
And you got 10 of them for how much?
$100.
Okay. Now, so we've come quite a way with our, 8-gig pen drives for a quarter of that.
Right. Well, a quarter of that. I think they come in Cheerios boxes now.
Pretty much.
And the 512K Mac didn't have a hard drive. Everything was off the floppy. So that was pretty important to get that. And then we bought one of the line feed printers. What do you call them? Dot matrix printers. And we paid extra to get the wide format one because we thought, you just got to be planning ahead for the future. And we never once needed to print wide format in the time we had it. And we bought a game of chess. We bought chess with that. So that was the coolest thing ever.
I always loved the noise of those dot matrix printers.
They make you happy.
It was something satisfying about it. And you could watch it line by line spitting out your picture or whatever.
Well, the next thing I was going to say was you talked about coming in on Panther, I think you said.
Yeah, it was 10.3, so I'm pretty sure that was Panther.
Now, I don't remember what the first OS was called, but I don't know that they even called it anything, actually had a name back then, but I remember distinctly with giddy excitement when OS 7 came out because it had Multi-Finder. We could have two applications open at the same time. Can you imagine? It's just like going from the iPhone to having two applications open the same time.
Or from DOS to Windows. But anyway.
Oh, man, that was just, I remember that breakthrough. That was just crazy time. And I would meet people who didn't know about it, and they were still launching one thing, quitting, and opening a different thing. And I showed them, and it was just, that was a big deal.
That reminds me of my first couple of months using Windows 3.1. I didn't realize that I could do multiple things at once because I was just so used to the DOS way of doing things.
I like it. Well, there, I did have throughout my journey, I mean, I'm not going to go through every Mac I own because that would be a long, long story. But I did have a brief period of doubt at one point where I wasn't sure Apple was going to survive. And instead of buying new, I bought my friend Ron's hand-me-down Quadra. I think it was a 610, something like that. And I bought that off of him instead of buying a new one. But every other one I've gotten has been, you know, brand new out of the box, and certainly would never go back. But I never actually even used Windows until I built a Windows PC for Kyle, but neither of us ever used it very much, so that didn't really count. But in January, I started using Windows at work, and I'd used a Mac at work nonstop since those early days in the early mid 80s. So now I get to use Vista. It's awesome. I love it.
Well, that's an experience. Character building, I believe, is the term.
Yeah, really, like living through a famine or something. But
except without the fatalities.
Exactly.
So far, you haven't thrown your Windows Vista machine through anyone yet.
Hey, we were talking about the Black Plague this morning, but I didn't talk about that at all. So let's see, that probably winds that up. We got another subject on the agenda here today. I wanted to talk about wikis and how cool wikis are, and I try to encourage people to maybe try using them because they just solve a ton of problems for me. You up for that?
Yeah, absolutely. I love wikis.
So some people, or most people, know about Wikipedia, but that's kind of intimidating because that's sort of an official wiki where, you know, you do, you know, all this important information sharing and everything. But I use wikis for all kinds of little things. I'm just collaborating with anybody on anything. I used it to organize a party one time to help have people figure out what they were going to bring. You want to work on a document with people, don't email it around in Word and try to edit in all the changes different people made. That's ridiculous. Just do it in a wiki. Trying to brainstorm even all by yourself. You just want to put down some ideas. I haven't launched Word yet on my new computer because I just do stuff in wikis instead.
Yeah, I have to say that when it's notes to myself, I have to say Evernote wins because it gets synchronized between all my Macs. But for anything that involves more than one person, wiki's all the way.
Yeah, see, I do it on the wiki because I can get to it from my iPhone. I can get to it from any Mac. I mean, I don't need to synchronize it. It's in one place, and everything can get to it. I suppose if I'm offline, but I'm pretty not much never offline anymore. One of the things I like about wikis is I'm trying to get away from worrying a lot about formatting. You know, if you're working in Microsoft Word writing a document, you spend a lot of time trying to get things to look right. That's really not value added to creating content. If you can use a wiki, there's just very, very simple formatting options. Not very much at all. I mean, you can make pretty much bold, italics, maybe make the font a little bit bigger or something like that. But you're not spending a lot of time just fooling around with that stuff, I think.
Actually, before wikis, I actually got to the point where I was using .txt files. Uh-huh. Because if you try to type in Word without using formatting, Word will insist on throwing some in anyway just to bugger everything up for you. And you copy and paste something in from somewhere else and suddenly it's like blue and huge and, you know. So I was actually using TextEdit with .txt files.
Hey, I used TextEdit about four times this week because I just wanted to make some notes to myself to remember to do some things. So I just pop open TextEdit. Why open Word to do that? I really am starting to realize that I don't need Word anymore.
But unless you need to write a letter or a CV or some actual word processing.
Yeah, I don't do that.
Although, I don't do it very often. I have to say, I don't own Word. I only own Pages. And the only reason I own Pages is because it comes with numbers, and I certainly do need numbers.
Hmm.
But I don't actually remember the last time I opened up Pages, now that you mention it.
Yeah.
It's entirely possible I've never launched it.
That's interesting. Well, back to wikis, you know, it makes it easy to share information with other people. It makes it possible for other people to change it. But even more importantly, they can comment on what you wrote. Like sometimes you're collaborating on something. So I might look at a sentence that you wrote and, you know, I might want to change it, but I don't, you know, you might be really emotionally attached to that sentence. So instead of actually changing what you wrote, I can just write a comment on the wiki that says, hey, would you consider doing a little change like this? I really love that part. That really seems to help make it a little more interesting because people can talk about it.
Maybe I'm just a little less considerate, but I just edit stuff.
Well, it kind of depends. It depends. You know, at work sometimes somebody's written something that they're pretty serious about, and I might not do a fundamental change, for example.
Yeah, I suppose it depends on how you rank compared to the person who wrote it.
One thing that I think I find a lot of people afraid of wikis. I keep trying to get people to use them at work where I'll just say, well, let's just throw that up in the wiki. And I'll even start it for them. And then they'll talk about it in an email instead of using the wiki. But I had a bunch of people coming over for a party at my house. And I created a little table. I made the invite in the wiki. And I created a little table where I put down everybody's name, how many people I thought were coming from their family and their names. And I put down and then left a column for here's what you're going to bring. And that was my subtle way of saying, yeah, you guys, it's a potluck. And every single person went in and edited it. There was one woman who had her daughter help her, but everybody else, and these are grown-ups, you know, people in their 50s who've never done it before. And they all went, oh, okay, Allison says we can edit this. Let's just go do it. And they were fearless. Cool. But people Excellent. At work seem to be fearful. Drives me crazy.
My line on that is always, can you send an email with you know, something like Gmail? And they go, yeah. And I go, okay, then you can edit a wiki.
Are you that smart, right? Now we
yeah,
don't.
It's the same thing. It's a little WYSIWYG editor. You just type. I mean, how hard can it be? Someone else has typed first. You just put in the cursor and type.
Exactly. One of the things I hate is collaborating on a document in Word. So you write up the document, and then you mail it out to a bunch of people, and you turn, if you're lucky, you've turned on, what do they call it,
Tracking.
Changes? Yeah, and then you get 12 copies of it back with all different changes. Now, how do you know that one guy didn't change what another guy did change, too? And so they've crossed over each other, and then you have to do all the editing and try to figure it out. But if you do it in a wiki, everybody can see what the latest change was.
Yeah, exactly. Trying to be a human source control machine and trying to merge everyone's edits into one. I mean, you know, in the software world, we've actually developed entire software systems for dealing with that, like Subversion and CVS. You don't want to do it as a human. That's just asking for trouble.
Definitely. One of the other nice features I think you were going to mention was what happens if I change the wiki?
Oh, I get an email.
Yeah. So you don't have to know to go look and see if somebody did something. You're going to get notified if you get a change to the wiki. Now, I think
it was good fun this week, actually, because I got to watch you and Namdar's discussion develop and blossom, even though I never actually logged into the wiki once.
Oh, I love it. I love it. That's cool. So what are other things you've used it for, Bart?
Well, the main use for it, I mean, you and I use it for, you know, structuring our chit-chat across the pond. Believe it or not, this is planned, folks.
It just sounds random.
Well, it depends on how planned it is. Some weeks it's quite random. But yeah, you know, sometime in the middle of the week in theory or Saturday morning in practice, one of us creates the wiki and, you know, we start putting in our ideas. But also for the International Mac podcast, we use it to build up our list of stories to talk about and assign them to people and stuff. And so I'd start the week by starting a new entry, you know, for this week's show. And then by Friday, in theory, all of our panelists will have added in their stories. And it works. It works very well.
Now, what tool do you use to do that?
We use Google Sites. And people may argue that Google Sites isn't, strictly speaking, a wiki. But considering it allows you to collaboratively edit documents, it counts as a wiki in my book.
Now, is that
and
different
I'm sure
than Google
we'll
Docs?
Well, it's Google Docs within a domain. So it's a different way of getting at Google Docs.
Now, I have not been impressed with Google Docs for editing. I created a... I forget what we needed. We need a list of people for snacks for cross country or something like that. And I did it over in Google Docs it might be Google Sites because we had a Google group. And it was a bear. This thing kept reformatting. I tried to make a table and it wouldn't do a table right. So I ended up doing it with tabs inside the Word sort of substitute. And somebody went in and edited a line and all of a sudden the formatting from there down got wrecked. I went in back and forth about five or six times trying to fix it. And I had to go into the wiki markup language to get rid of these bizarre characters that had gotten entered in some way. And it was horrible. It was very buggy. I was really, really disappointed in that, actually.
Okay, perhaps Google Sites is not Google Docs, because none of this is anything remotely familiar. And I use many different browsers depending on where I am when I'm editing. And I haven't noticed this. So Google Sites, it's sort of like a content management system. You know, you create a main page and you create sub pages off it. And they're called a page rather than a document.
Right. I'm not sure which I was using. I'll have to go back and find out and let you know.
Because you don't end up saving, like, you know, Word document files or anything. You build up a web page, basically, and you do it through a simple WYSIWYG editor like you would have in Gmail or whatever.
Yeah, that's
and everyone
what this
can
is.
Edit it, and you get a list of, you know, so-and-so's edited it, so-and-so's edited it, so-and-so's edited.
Hmm. This definitely isn't saving a Word file or anything like that. It's just a web page, so I'll have to go back and check. But I'll tell you what I really like is what we use for Chit Chat Across the Pond is PB Wiki, which I think originally started as Peanut Butter Wiki.
It's a okay, little why?
I don't know. It's got a little peanut butter sandwich
actually,
in the icon.
We've been talking about wikis, and you haven't told the funny story about where the name comes from.
Oh, I believe it comes from the Hawaiian word for quick. Like, if you go to Hawaii and you want to take the little shuttle bus that gets you quickly around the airport, it's called the Wiki Wiki Bus.
Yeah.
It means fast.
And so the guy who invented the wiki wanted a quick way to make web pages, so we called it a Wiki Wiki. But then he decided that was too much, like, you know, too difficult to say. So it became Wiki.
I like it. I like it. Well, Peanut Butter Wiki, we'd been using for a long time in the 1.0 version. Then they were coming out with the 2.0 version. And for some reason, I resisted the change, but I'm loving the new version.
Well, I'm absolutely positively head over heels with the new version. I should have badgered you more to change it.
What do you like about it?
Well, the fact that I'm now a full user and can actually create pages is nice.
That's right. I used to have to invite you by sending you a double secret link that iCal would sometimes decide whether or not it would decide to send it to you.
Yeah, it was this bizarre thing where it would have like a secret code on the end. And if I went to the URL with the secret code, I got editing access. And if I went to the URL without the secret code, I didn't. Whereas now it's much more straightforward. I log in with my email address and a password. I get to see a list of everything that's been changed. Stuff is in folders, which makes it all so much easier to find. The interface has been really nicely, you know, nice and simple, minimalist interface with nice, unoffensive pastel colors. Quick, easy, cute, very web 2.0 with rounded corners, unfortunately. But, you know, it's nice and it's intuitive. It's just easy to use, you know, gets out of your way. I'm very impressed with it.
Now, I was originally worried that it didn't have a wiki markup language because I'm so used to wikis like MediaWiki, which is the wiki that Wikipedia is based on, and Confluence, which is a commercial wiki application. I'm always having to go into the out of the WYSIWYG editor into the markup language to fix bizarre problems that crop up where you hit a carriage return and all of a sudden all your formatting gets wrecked and stuff like that. But you showed me that I actually can view the source in editing, so I can go into that, but I haven't needed to once yet.
No, neither have I. The editor has been very well behaved.
Yeah, I'm really, really impressed. I can't stand how often I have to screw around with it in MediaWiki and Confluence. It puts in these ampersand NBSP, I think it is, which is
non-breaking space.
Right. They just grow out of nowhere, and I have to go back and clean them up. And they look like, I mean, it totally ruins it. It's just, yeah, the first thing you have to do in Confluence is turn off the WYSIWYG editor.
Yeah. No, I'm really impressed with this editor. It's behaving itself very nicely. And like you say, it's HTML under the hood rather than being a wiki markup language. So I prefer that.
Is that why? Okay. So they have a personal version, which is what we're using, which is free. And you get 2 gigabytes of file storage on that for free. And then they have a business and an academic version of it. I didn't go too far into it, but one of the things I did find out was with the 2 premium accounts, you get unlimited data storage on it.
Okay, but in terms of text, 2 gigabytes may as well be unlimited.
Yeah, that's true. But the reason the part I read about that was they actually have document control, so you can upload documents, PDFs, photos, whatever you need, images, things you want to work on. Mm. You can upload those into PB Wiki, and so that's why the storage requirements might be interesting.
Yeah, if you start adding in lots of images and other big files, you'll get to 2 gigs quick enough.
Yeah. Now, I did notice something else I really like about PB Wiki that's not true in any other wiki I've used. I can use shortcut keystrokes. I can use Command-B or Control-B on Windows to make something bold.
Oh, I hadn't noticed that.
I just tried it on a lark, and it worked. So you don't have to drag your mouse all the way up to the bar and put it in. I also like when you're editing, the save button is always on your screen. On the other editors, yeah. I notice I always have to scroll down to get to the edit, to the save button. It drives me nuts.
Yeah, it sort of follows you around. It's like, you're probably going to need me.
Yeah, exactly, because you are.
Yeah, very true.
The comments are really easy. Oh, one thing we haven't talked about. What's great about editing in a wiki, like where we were talking about where you claim you're less considerate, but that you would go in and edit something somebody wrote. One of the magical parts of wikis is that it keeps a history of all of the changes. So you can go back and compare two people's between two versions of it, and you can actually discard changes and go back to a previous version.
Yeah, which is why Wikipedia has a chance of working, so that if someone vandalizes it, the admins go, okay, we'll just rewind a step.
Yeah, yeah.
And the other nice thing, actually, with the emails that get sent out is they contain the changes. So you will see in context, so it'll have a little bit before and after. Anything new that gets added goes in green. Anything that you get deleted goes red with a stroke through. So I can see that you deleted the word premium because you spelled it wrong and then put in the word premium spelled correctly.
Did I? You're using it as an example, or did I actually do that?
No, you did that. Oh. This is unlimited on premium. Actually, no, you spelled it right twice, but you replaced it with itself.
Oh, okay.
Go figure. But anyway, it's really easy to see what's deleted because it's red on a red background and red text with a red line through it. And then this new stuff is on a dark green on a bright green background. Really, it just stands out really well. It's nicely done.
I think they did a great job with this. So bottom line, I would say I really recommend to people, if you're ever trying to write anything with somebody else, even organizing a party, just even writing by yourself, keeping notes on something you want to remember. I really like PBWiki and wikis in general.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the way to go. And especially if you have a group or an organization, Google Docs or PBWiki or something like that, where you can collaboratively work on the same thing. It makes life so much simpler. It's just easy.
Definitely, definitely. I like it. Well, any other notes on wikis, or are we about done there?
I think we're about done with wikis. The only thing is I got my calendars, so I'm very happy with them.
Oh, this is here from Apple. You're happy again.
Oh, Well, I hadn't seen my calendars. They came this week, and I think they came this week. Or did we talk about this last week? And am I just being silly?
No, they were on their way. You had gotten your.
They were on their way.
Start.
Okay, I'm not being silly. No, they come in these beautiful boxes as well, which are there's something really reassuring about that Apple logo on a box. But they're these beautiful green and white boxes with this beautiful white Apple logo on them, and everything about the experience gives you this feeling of quality. And you open them up and there they are staring back at you in glorious color. Good thick paper, it's nice glossy printing, good deep rich colors. I'm really happy with the calendar, so I'm gonna have to make one for myself, because the three I made are for giving away, so now I definitely want one for myself.
Now wait a minute, you haven't been grumpy once in this entire recording. What's up with that?
If you want me to be grumpy, I can mention that my bank today decided not to process any plastic.
What do you mean, any plastic?
Their credit card validation servers died.
Oh.
So every time you try to use your credit card online, it came back as do not honor.
Oh, no.
So I thought, oh my God, what's happened? Have I gone over my limit or something? But no, I checked in on internet banking. I was well away from my limit. And I rang them up and they sheepishly said, well, actually, it's broken. But we're working on it. Jeez. And they said, oh, it's debit and credit cards.
So
all of my plastic was gone.
You're broke today.
It came back online because I really wanted to register a domain name, because I've had an idea. I'm not going to talk about it now, but I've had this idea that may actually hypothetically make some money for me someday. Maybe.
Hot doggies.
It may just be a fun project. I haven't quite decided if I want to make money off it, but I think it's a good idea. But I'm not going to talk about it until it's done. So actually in the middle of coding it up now.
All right. Well, the secret's safe with us. So I remember one time Steve went to take money out of an ATM. This is years ago when we were with Bank of America, and ATMs were fairly new. And he went to take some money out of his account, and it said he was overdrawn. And he was like, what the heck? And it said that his account was closed. So he called him up on the phone. and the guy says, oh, Mr. Sheridan, we've spoken several times. We're really tired of this. You're overdrawn. You don't have any money. You got to stop bugging us. And Steve is just like going crazy about this. And so I know what it was. He had tried to do something and he was told he was overdrawn. So he went to the ATM and it proved that he had money in his account. So when he called him, he was furious at this guy, right? So it turns out there was another Stephen P. Sheridan at the same bank, and they hadn't checked Social Security numbers. They had done it by name.
Ooh.
So he was furious with this guy, right? So he the guy apologizes. They get it all figured out and everything at the end. But Steve is still furious. The next month they did it again.
God.
Needless to say, Steve was no longer with Bank of America after that. That was the end of
it. I'm assuming they sorted themselves out.
Well, yeah, this was probably a decade ago, but it was still, it was like, talk about grumpy.
Good goodness gracious. There's nothing worse. You know, with all this money being virtual and in the cloud, it's the ultimate horror story when suddenly, you know, the technology gets it wrong and says you have no money and no one can believe you because it doesn't physically exist anywhere.
Yeah, it's like feeling your air supply cut off, isn't it?
Oh, it's a horrible feeling. I nearly jumped out of my chair. It's like, what do you mean, do not honor? You know, have I just been blacklisted? I mean, it's not a particularly nice error message.
Gives me the willies. Well, I'm glad we ended on a grumpy note. People wouldn't recognize the chit-chat without it, right?
Apparently, people like when I'm grumpy, which I think is terrible. It means I have to have a bad life to make people happy.
That's the way you go about it. It's a lot of fun. Well, are we looking good for next weekend?
We are. We'll have to be a little imaginative with the timing because next weekend is my Christmas party weekend. I have a work party and then I have another party and then I have another party. But I'm sure I'll squeeze it in there somewhere.
So you might even be more entertaining.
It depends on whether it happens before or after the alcohol, yes.
All right, Bart. Well, we'll talk to you next week then.
Okie dokie. Until then, happy computing.
Oh my gosh, it's an hour and 15 minutes into the show. Holy cow, I better cut this thing off. You know, I've been talking to the chat room here, and they said to keep it this long. I thought maybe I should move Jane out to next week. Maybe I should move the interview with Sean from Box.net out. But no, they said make it long. In fact, Mac Trucker said it's his fault. All right, well, I am going to wind it up now. If you want to be part of the exciting chat room, be sure to join us at 5 p.m. GMT-8. That's Pacific Standard Time. On Sunday nights over at ustream.tv/nosillacast. Now, that's my normal time, but next Sunday, the 21st, I'll be recording probably earlier in the day on Sunday. I haven't decided what time, but maybe like, I don't know, 2 or 3 o'clock. So keep an eye on Twitter. Follow me on twitter.com/podfeet because I'll give you guys a heads up when I'm ready. So be sure to check that out. But most times it's 5 p.m. GMT-8 on Sunday nights. Be sure to email compliments, complaints, and of course those very important dumb questions to nosillacast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. Stay subscribed.